Backchat Backtalk.
Hey, you're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5. It's good morning. It's Saturday, November 18th. My name's Holly Payne. I'm joined, as ever, by the wonderful Sita Rizaghi, and we are broadcasting from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and we pay our respects to elders past and present.
Howdy. You're tuned into Backchat. So, Holly, earlier this week, the High Court made a significant decision in favour of the rights of stateless asylum seekers who have been indefinitely detained by Australia for years and decades for some. We're going to be breaking down what this new law means for refugees and what more needs to be done for their rights with the coordinator from Refugee Action Coalition, Ian Rintoul.
And later on, we'll be joined by Green Senator Maureen Faruqi to talk about the party's latest moves on the war in Gaza.
And before that, we're going to be chatting about a new project to understand the experiences of women's safety across the city. And of course, if any of that pricked your ears, and get in touch. Have you been attending any of the rallies for Palestine over the last few weeks? Let us know your thoughts. How's the energy on the ground? Text us on 0409945945 or DM us on Instagram at BackchatFBI.
Backchat.
Text 0409945945.
First up, how safe do you feel in your city? Do you still ask your mates to text you when they get home after a night out? Macquarie University has just launched a project to understand the experiences of women and gender diverse people all across New South Wales, and we're joined by lovely producer Beck to chat us through.
Hello.
So Beck, tell us, what's been your experience of safety around Sydney, hey?
I feel like I walk into the world a little bit too confident, and I think that I'm safe wherever I go, but I also know that all of my friends, women and queer people that I know are very much not in the same camp. There is a huge sense of lack of safety, especially after dark in our city. What do you think? How have you been feeling?
Honestly, I've had a few iffy things happen when I've gone out and about. But for the most part, it's like, even if you feel safe, there's always that sense of fear. It's always your friends text me when you get home. And it's like, you might not even feel safe, but the fact that that's the underlying theme of every night is it says something about our culture.
Yeah, and I was chatting to Dr. Nikki Carms from the project called Your Ground, and she said the sense of feeling safe and also being safe are both equally as important. And at the moment, they only really have anecdotal evidence, like our experiences here and experience of our friends and family. It's all researchers really have to go on, and there's not a lot for projects to get funded, and they really need a wealth of qualitative data that they don't have access to at the moment. And it's a really under-researched area.
So, what's the solution here?
So XYX Lab, which is run out of Macquarie Uni, they've just launched a crowd mapping website called Your Ground, and that anyone can access from New South Wales, and they can add their experiences too. It was officially launched on Wednesday, so it's fairly new, but it already has over 1,000 entries on the map. If you want to have a look, it's www.yourground.org. The data's public, so everyone can go on and see what other people have said and look at where people have identified safe or unsafe public spaces. They said that the project being open for us to also be able to access the data and not locked up in research is a really important part of the project. There are experiences from people that range from quite positive to some entries that are potentially quite distressing to read. So there's a bit of a warning there if you do want to go and have a look.
Yeah, I have a few instances where I can pop in my own experience, but mine are oftentimes on public transport, funnily enough.
A lot of the entries are at public transport stations and things like that. Yeah.
Do you want to walk us through how the project's dealing with some of those kind of more distressing stories?
Yeah, well, the first thing to protect people who are adding their stories is that it's all anonymous. And while the team from XYX wants to make all of this as transparent as possible, there are some levels of content moderation. They're removing content that refers to businesses, private venues, or troll or attack people based on gender identity, sexual orientation, race, religion, or ability, etc. And they are moderated slightly to get flagged so that really traumatic content isn't obviously open and public for everyone to see. I chatted to the project lead, Dr. Nikki Carms, about how they're going to manage this a couple of days ago.
Correct. People, women and gender diverse people, want to share often things that are really not great things that are happening to them in public space. But unless we know about them, we can't really do a lot about them. And embedded within that risk is the fact that when when you see someone who's sharing a similar story to yours, you don't feel so isolated. You feel that there's a kind of solidarity around some of those issues. And we know from the work that we've done with women and gender diverse people is that the benefit of actually seeing that data and contributing to that data set outweighs maybe some of those risky things.
And Beck, what are they going to do with all this data?
So the team at Macquarie is going to use this data on a local level to add to the huge research gap on safety for women and gender diverse people, like we mentioned. But it's also going to be collected as part of the project and disclosed publicly or shared with other government agencies to unlock new benefits for our communities, improve services, support innovation, research, academia, and specialised industry organisations. And on a larger scale, this data may also be used to integrate safety into our city planning and looking at our city infrastructure that's going to help in future.
Absolutely. Beck, thank you so much for coming in and chatting to us about this.
No worries.
Alrighty, look, next up we're going to be chatting with Ian Rintal from Refugee Action Collective about the some of the big changes that happened this week from that High Court decision.
You're on FBI 94.5.
Earlier this month, the High Court made a decision that will impact the lives of stateless refugees indefinitely detained in our detention centres. It was lauded as a major win by refugee advocates and former refugees.
To break down what this decision means for those who have come to our shore in search for a safer life, we're joined by Ian Rintal, coordinator from Refugee Action Collective. Ian, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So last week, the High Court of Australia passed a landmark decision around indefinite detention that impacts many asylum seekers. Just briefly, like, what did the High Court decide here?
What the High Court decided was that if someone can't be removed, if it's impracticable for people to be removed in the foreseeable future, then they cannot be detained. And so it put an end to 20 years of the former Al-Khateb decision, which had been taken in 2004, been tested so many times, which established that indefinite detention, it was called administrative detention, was lawful. Thankfully, that's gone.
And what does that decision mean for the 92 people in immigration detention in early November?
Well, we think it's more than 92, actually, but there's at least 92 that Home Affairs have admitted to. But what they were looking at was life imprisonment, and they'd been told that. That even though they had, for some of them who had committed crimes, they'd been sentenced under the criminal justice system, they'd served their time in imprisonment, they'd been released from prison, but just because they're non-citizens, they could be, have their visas cancelled and be detained. Many of them have done longer in immigration detention than they did, you know, in prison. But so people were looking for life sentences for traffic offences, for fraud, for, you know, common assault. The government talks a lot about the paedophiles and sex offenders and murderers. They don't talk about the large numbers of people are there for much minor offences.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, they've served their time and aren't getting released back into the community. And what have refugees been saying about the decision?
Look, people were overwhelmed. They're still overwhelmed. There's a lot of people inside who are still expecting to get out. But they're people who hadn't seen their families for 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, 8 years. Then they've had families coming to visit them in Villawood and other detention centres. I mean, families have been separated because their families are in Melbourne and they're in Yonge Hill. So they were, overjoyed because, like many other people, they did the crime, served the time, they should be free, and the consequences of not being free is absolutely extraordinary.
And just briefly, why was Australia able to lock up people indefinitely in detention centres who had come here seeking asylum?
I think that the government just has to face up to the fact that the law that the indefinite detention law was racist and discriminatory. Like, they can take these extraordinary extrajudicial punishments, and that's what they were. They were simply government-inspired measures. They could cancel the visa and hold people indefinitely because they were non-citizens. I think it's this ultimate definition of, racist and, discriminatory, but that's ultimately what it was. The Migration Act in Australia is simply an act about excluding people from Australia, excluding people from the community, and that's why it's not something which enshrines the rights of asylum seekers or refugees. It's about, you know, prohibiting and prescribing, restricting, those rights. But the Al-Khattab decision in 2004 had established the fiction that there was judicial punishment and there was also administrative detention, that somehow or other, you know, like 4 years, 5 years in immigration detention wasn't punishment, it was administrative. It was always a nonsense, but said thankfully that's been overturned.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio, where we're breaking down what the new changes are for refugees in indefinite detention who are stateless. Ian, look, it's not all good news, though, as a few days ago, the government passed a law to impose curfews and electronic monitoring devices on released detainees. What's the reaction to this news been? You know, some people have called it detention by another name.
Well, it will be, and hopefully we'll see some legal challenges to it. Again, people, they're very happy to be getting out. They're very happy to be out, you know, but the consequences now of police actually visiting their homes, of trying to impose these orders now, the probability that they're going to have, ankle bracelets and monitoring bracelets and the curfews. And I think people are generally astounded. I mean, I don't think it's shafted home yet to the people who have been released, although they have been horrified. Some people's homes have been visited by police even though they haven't been released. So there's obviously a degree of collaboration between Home Affairs and state police that's already creating the impression that you're under surveillance, we're watching you, there's going to be problems. But for the refugee advocates, if you like, I mean, we're just horrified. It is disgusting to see the Labor Party, imposing these kinds of measures, cringing before Dutton, and imposing this just horrific, hang 'em, flog 'em, bash 'em, kind of approach. It reflects their attitude to asylum seekers in any case. It's a reflection of that. They try to exclude refugees from coming here. Now they are refugees, recognised that they should be in the community, have the rights of everyone else in the community, but they're being discriminated against in the same way that they faced when they actually tried to get here in the first place.
And, we've had a series of governments who have not had any refugee or asylum seeker stances. What does the Refugee Action Coalition want to see from the government for refugees, or what want them to do for these refugees here?
I think there's so many things that need to be got rid of. We need to get rid of mandatory detention. We need to get rid of Section 501, of the Migration Act, which allows them. It is the way in which they have been able to use extrajudicial powers against people who are non-citizens. Section 501 should go. There should be a criminal justice system. We accept that. That should be the end of the story. But more widely, we need to get rid of the detention apparatus which surrounds the whole idea of asylum seekers. Ultimately, we need to have a welcome asylum policy. People who come here, no matter how they come here, by boat or plane or anywhere else, are actually welcomed into the community, are free to live in the community while their claims are assessed, instead of facing the barrage of policy restrictions. We need to get rid of offshore detention, which is an apparatus which is still there. The Labor Party has maintained the whole architecture, of mandatory. They haven't got indefinite detention in quite the same way, but now we've got arbitrary detention, the ankle bracelets. We've still got offshore detention. All those things, have to go.
Ian, thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
That was Ian Rintoul from the Refugee Action Coalition on how the recent High Court decision means stateless refugees in detention centres can finally be released, and how there's still a lot of work that needs to be done for refugee rights in our country.
Next up, we're going to be taking a deep dive into how Australian politics is responding to the war in Palestine and Israel with Greens Senator Maureen Faruqi.
Backchat.
Text 0409-945-945.
All right, welcome back. Now, the war in Israel and Palestine is entering its sixth week, and it's easy to feel like any action we take in Australia as, citizens is pretty futile. But that's not always the case, and we wanted to take a look at what real grassroots political action can achieve.
Earlier this week, Greens leader Adam Bandt tabled two massive petitions calling for a ceasefire in Parliament. And the week before that, Greens Senator Maureen Faruqi led a walkout during question time. Just a heads up, we're going to be covering some pretty heavy topics for the next 10 minutes or so.
Before we kick things off, we wanted to acknowledge that there's a difference between Jewish people and the State of Israel, and we're going to be talking about the State of Israel today, and not those of Jewish people as a group. But we're joined in the studio today by Green Senator Maureen Faruqi. Maureen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Holly and Tanita. It's lovely, always lovely to be here with you.
Maureen, so you've said that you're bringing the people's protests into Parliament. Do you want to give us a quick summary of the actions Greens have taken to date?
So the Labour government's refusal to condemn the State of Israel for their war crimes, for their collective punishment, for the massacre of thousands of Palestinians is galling and is unacceptable. And the Australian people, looking on the horrors that are being inflicted on Palestinians and seeing thousands of children being killed, like one child being murdered every 10 minutes, you know, they're horrified by that. But they're also horrified by their own government showing complicity and basically shielding Israel from these war crimes. That's why we see weekend after weekend tens of thousands of people marching on streets across this country. And that's why the Greens took this people's protest into Parliament a couple of weeks ago. And every single day since then, we have been protesting in some way, shape or form. So I led that walkout last week in Parliament. We have tried to table the names of the people that we know who have been murdered and massacred in Gaza. The government did not allow us to do that. And why I tried to table those is because people want to forget their names. No one wants to actually look at the truth. And when I say no one, I'm talking mainly about the Labour government, wants to see the truth in the eye and actually act on it. We tried to move a motion to have a vote on the Australian government calling for a ceasefire. We were stopped from doing that. When we were stopped from doing that, we held up signs in the Senate which called for a ceasefire now. We've been speaking every single day in Parliament about Palestine. And as I have said before, I will not stop talking about Palestine until there is a ceasefire and there is justice for Palestinians. And we have joined protest and stood and walked shoulder to shoulder with the thousands upon thousands of people marching.
And of the two petitions that Adam Bandt tabled in Parliament this week, one was specifically from healthcare workers. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what makes healthcare workers an important group to listen to in this conflict.
Well, healthcare workers are on the front lines. They are the first responders to any death and devastation of catastrophes and disasters that happens around the world. And that is the case now as well. There are healthcare workers who are trying to do their best under such difficult circumstances in Gaza. And healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, do have, they're ethically, you know, medically ethically bound by doing no harm to their patients and by actually working to the best of their ability for the welfare of their patients. And what we are seeing is happening in Gaza is that doctors, despite trying their best, just don't have the equipment or the medicine to be able to do that. You know, doctors are being killed. We know that premature babies did not have incubators. We have seen cesareans being performed or, you know, without any pain relief. And doctors and medical healthcare workers here are seeing that, and they are saying that we cannot remain silent while we see deaths and murder of thousands upon thousands of people. And I think we ought to listen to them because they know the trauma that this is causing every single day. So it was really powerful and pretty gutsy of healthcare workers in Australia to come to Parliament, get this petition of so many thousands of people signed, and, you know, kind of force the Labour government and our Prime Minister to confront the realities and to also confront that their inaction is actually contributing to the continuation of this massacre of Palestinians.
And have we started to see a shift from our governing party yet? I mean, there are reports talking about how Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong's rhetoric has started to shift.
I must say that I was very inspired by the 56 UK Labour politicians who broke ranks and, you know, defied their own party leader to vote for a ceasefire in Gaza. We did see, because of the pressure of the community, that at least two Labour backbenchers stood with the Greens and the healthcare workers when we called for a ceasefire. But, you know, the community and the constituents of Labour MPs who voted for them, who put them in power, are feeling totally betrayed. They are horrified and they're angered that their MPs are not representing them. And we have heard from many of them, and I know that Labour MPs and the Foreign Minister and the Prime Minister has also heard from so many of them, telling them that they no longer feel represented by the Prime Minister or the Foreign Minister. But because of their pressure, I think because the calls for a ceasefire are going getting louder and stronger, it is getting harder and harder for the Labour government to keep shielding, to keep defending the atrocities that are being committed by the State of Israel. And you can actually see their discomfort. So their language and their rhetoric is definitely changing. We heard the Foreign Minister say that they'd like to take steps towards a ceasefire. You know, we heard the Prime Minister actually say in Parliament the other day that he has a track record for standing up for the rights and justice for Palestinian people. But up to now, their actions actually are belying their words. But, you know, I think things are going to shift soon, because we can see them squirm. And that is part of us exposing them every single day in Parliament. You know, so they cannot ignore the calls that they might want to ignore from outside, from the streets, from their constituents.
Maureen, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. And just a reminder, there are protests happening tomorrow, people. So go and fight for justice and peace.
Today is a big day for Backchat as we bid farewell to our beloved executive producer, Eamon Snow. For those of you who don't know Eamon, he's been the glue who's kept Backchat going for the last few years, and he's the reason why we have a show to air every Saturday.
God, I could say so much about Eamon. I mean, Eamon has led Backchat over the last 2 years and has left a massive lasting impression on so many of us, whether you've worked on the show directly or just had interactions with him throughout the station. He's led us through multiple election coverages, a global conflict, and ensured that we've always had stories to tell you from Sydney that you can't miss. Eamon effect is felt far and wide amongst the team, and here's some things that we have to say.
Eamon, it's Charlie here. Happy last day at Backchat. I can't believe the time has come. There's so much to celebrate about you. I want to start off with calling out your constant diligence when dealing with everything from complex stories from across Sydney to complex deadlines. You always put in 100%, and it really, really, really showed. Also, your emotional intelligence. I know everybody in the team could always count on you for support. No matter what, you were always there, and that's really special. And also just your endless reserves of patience. I've never met anybody as patient as you. You always gave everybody a fair go. You're wicked smart, and any news bureau that you land in should count their lucky stars that you're there. Love you big time, man. Best of luck.
Eamon's been such an incredible leader. I can only imagine how difficult it can be to manage a group of volunteers in a news environment, but he's handled it with so much grace, especially with the